today's episode, we are going to Indiana, USA. The date is the 18th of August, 1987. On this day, 15-year-old Sean Lamont Rowe and 13-year-old Ronald Lee Sanford were walking through their neighborhood in the hope of doing some yard work in return for money for the Indiana State Fair. They ended up at the house of two sisters, Anna Louise Harris and Julie Belmar. This interaction would have a deadly conclusion, and 13-year-old Ronald Sanford would be staring down the barrel of a 170-year prison sentence. Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 5 of the Students' Verdict podcast. Thank you for joining me. For those of you who are new, my name is Emily and I'm your host. If you haven't already, please go and listen to our earlier episodes, which include cases such as the Monster of Worcester and the cases of Kanika Jenkins and Kendrick Johnson. Also, please follow us on Instagram at the Student Verdict blog and on Twitter at Student Verdict. Resources used in this episode will always be linked in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review, and if you don't enjoy it, then never mind. With all of that said, let's get started on today's episode. On his cell wall, Ronald Lee Sanford has the phrase, "No man is your enemy, no man is your friend, every man is your teacher." In an interview with WTHR, a 40-year-old Sanford recalled feeling terrified walking into Michigan City Prison when he was just 15. But how does a juvenile end up in prison at just 15? Sean Lamont Rowe, 15, and Ronald Lee Sanford, then 13, had decided they were going to get money for the state fair. They set about finding work that might earn them that money. This was their goal as they approached the 300 block of Harvard Place, the home of two elderly sisters, Anna Harris, 83, and Julie Belmar, 87. Rowe and Sanford suspected that the women had money, so when the boys' offer of yard work was rejected, in a split-second decision, they decided to force their way into the home. It's believed that the women were tortured and beaten before they were murdered, and their bodies were left in the basement. Both sisters had been stabbed to death multiple times. Rowe would later leave the sisters' home with just $5 for the fare. After the deaths of the sisters, neighbours were understandably fearful. In one newspaper, a neighbour said the following, quote, "They, criminals, haven't invaded us yet, but it's getting too close to home. We have contact with the police through our neighbourhood watch. At least we know who to call if anything looks suspicious." In 1988, a year after the murders, Sean Rowe was arrested. Upon his arrest, he immediately requested a plea deal where he would testify against Sanford in exchange for a lesser sentence. Rowe denied involvement in the murders, claiming that he was a bystander. As a result of his plea deal, most of the charges against Rowe were dropped. He was therefore only charged with assisting a robbery, to which he entered a guilty plea on the 22nd of March 1989. For his part, Rowe received a sentence of 5 years, 11 months, and 30 days. In March 1988, the state charged Ronald Lee Sanford as a juvenile for his role in the stabbing deaths. In April 1988, the court sent Sanford's case from the juvenile to the adult court, where he was charged with 2 counts of murder, 2 counts of Class A felony robbery, 2 counts of Class B felony criminal confinement, 1 count of Class A felony burglary, and 2 counts of felony murder. As his trial approached, Sanford was advised by his public defender to plead guilty to the charges of double murder, robbery with bodily harm, and burglary, on the understanding that his age and lack of conclusive evidence would be taken into account. Remember, the state's case relied heavily on the testimony of the co-defendant, Sean Rowe. There was little independent evidence to corroborate who played what part in the events that unfolded on that August day in 1987. In March 1989, Sanford, now 15 years old, entered guilty pleas to the two charges of murder, one count of Class A felony robbery, and one count of Class B felony burglary. The remaining charges were dismissed by the state. The plea agreement left sentencing open. The following month, in April 1989, the court sentenced Ronald Sanford to 50 years for each count of murder, 50 years for robbery, and 20 years for burglary. The judge explained that these sentences were to be served consecutively, as opposed to concurrently, which amounted to a sentence of 170 years in total. Under his sentence, Sanford would not be eligible for parole until the year 2070, when he will be 96 years old. I think we need to look at how a 13-year-old becomes involved in a double murder in the first place. We'll start by looking at Ronald Sanford's background. Ronald Lee Sanford was born on the 12th of February 1974. When describing being raised in a single-parent household, Sanford said that he had no consistent fatherly influence growing up, as his mother's boyfriends would come and go. His mother, Pamela Johnson, experienced issues with alcoholism, which caused her to act out physically. With the violence he experienced in his childhood, Sanford described to interviewers feeling like he was trained to kill. When asked to elaborate, a now 40-year-old Sanford said the following, quote, "It's easy to get to the violence when you have already been in the gas. When you've been in the violence, it's easy to be violent. Children become what they see. They mimic the examples they follow." It should be noted that since his incarceration, Sanford's mother has received help. She's clean and sober and went to school for nursing. Ronald Sanford and Sean Rowe became friends as they both attended Shortridge High School. They were described fondly as close buddies, but the principal, Alfred Finnell Jr., recalled them as a tough guy and his follower. He said that all Sanford's teachers experienced problems with him, but Sean Rowe only acted out if Ronald was there. Sanford was taller than Rowe and was said to be the leader of a group at the school. Principal Finnell said, quote, "Often a lot of kids will look up to the tough guy image. A lot of kids become followers of those types of individuals. I'd say Sean would be the follower in this case." To the reporter, the principal went on to set out Sanford's disciplinary record, which included two suspensions the autumn before and nearly 6 weeks' worth of absences. Sanford was failing his courses when it was discovered that he had moved from his mother's address at 301 Harvard Place to his grandfather's on 1425 North Mount Street. When her son was implicated in the murders, Sanford's mother said, quote, "Not in my wildest dreams. I don't know why they picked Ronald. He's a good child, and a 13-year-old couldn't do something like this." It was later alleged by Sanford that on the day the murders were committed, his mother had left him home alone as she had left town for the weekend with a boyfriend. Sanford's police record included arrests for beating one schoolmate and threatening another with a knife. According to state corrections records, Sanford's criminal history started at the age of just 10, with an arrest for theft on the 14th of August 1984, just 3 years and 4 days before the murders of Anna Harris and Julie Belmar. The theft charge would be dismissed after restitution was made, but 2 years later, Sanford was arrested for attempted burglary. This was later reduced to criminal mischief, and he was placed on probation. On the 1st of January 1987, he was arrested for battery with injury. He was committed to the Indiana Boys School, but the punishment was suspended. 5 months later, he was arrested for theft while on probation. Again, he was given a suspended sentence. It was because of his lengthy criminal record that the deputy prosecutor said they felt that a 13-year-old Ronald Sanford was beyond rehabilitation. Before we start talking about the legal stuff, I'd just like to preface this by saying that although I work in criminal defence, I'm a trainee solicitor in the UK and not the United States where this case is set. I've conducted research into the relevant case law, which we will be discussing, but I am by no means an expert. Now, in civil matters, state and federal laws recognise the immaturity and irresponsibility of children. For example, you have to be at least 18 to vote, sign contracts, or to serve on a jury, and you need parental consent to get married. Yet, in the criminal justice system, a juvenile, so that's someone under the age of 18 and even as young as 10, who commits a crime, can be treated as an adult. Under international law, sentencing children to die in prison is condemned. The Juvenile Law Centre says that life without parole and other extremely lengthy sentences keep these juveniles in prison well past the point at which they have been rehabilitated and well beyond any reasonable risk of reoffending. Before 1980, life without parole was rarely imposed on children, but the number of child offenders who received this sentence each year began to increase in the late 1980s. By the end of 2016, there were 2,310 people serving life without parole sentences for crimes committed as juveniles. Now, on to the case law. In the case of Roper v. Simmons, 2005, the Supreme Court ruled that juveniles could not be sentenced to death, writing that the death penalty is a disproportionate punishment for the young. Following this case, 12 states banned the death penalty in all circumstances and 18 more banned it for juvenile offenders. This case affected 72 juveniles on death row. Between 1976 and the Roper case, 22 individuals were executed for crimes committed as juveniles. In Graham v. Florida 2010 case, the Supreme Court banned the use of life without parole for juveniles not convicted of a homicide. The ruling applied to at least 123 prisoners. The court called life without parole an especially harsh punishment for a juvenile. For example, where a 15-year-old and a 70-year-old are both sentenced to life without parole, the saying life without parole will have very, very different meanings for both of those defendants. Finally, in the cases of Miller v. Alabama and Jackson v. Hobbs, 2012, the Supreme Court held that for juveniles, mandatory life without parole sentences violated the Eighth Amendment. That's the one that says cruel and unusual punishments should not be inflicted. Finally, in the case of Montgomery v. Louisiana, 2016, the court ruled in favour of Henry Montgomery, who had been imprisoned in Louisiana with no chance of parole since 1963, after receiving a conviction when he was a juvenile. The court held that prisoners previously given automatic life sentences with no chance of parole for crimes committed as juveniles must have their cases reviewed for resentencing or be considered for parole. Alison Parker, a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch, summed it up nicely by saying, quote, "Kids who commit serious crimes shouldn't go scot-free, but if they are too young to vote or buy cigarettes, they are too young to spend the rest of their lives behind bars." So what are some of the issues in Ronald Sanford's case? I wanted to cover this case for two reasons. The first is that out of all the articles I've published on the Students' Verdict blog, the case of Ronald Sanford still gets the most attention by far. I think it's a really thought-provoking case, which leads me on to my second reason, which is that Ronald Sanford's case is in stark contrast to another case that was covered, we covered earlier in the Student's Verdict podcast, which was the case of the Monster of Worcester. This is a case from England, where I'm from. David McGreevy murdered three children whom he was babysitting. All of the children were under the age of 5 years old. He beat one, strangled the second, and slit the throat of the third. He then impaled their bodies on a neighbour's wrought iron fence. The judge in that case recommended life with a minimum term of 20 years. McGreevy was eventually released after serving 40 years. The mother of the three children didn't believe that her children's murderer should ever have been released, saying that there were people who had committed far less serious offences who were never allowed to leave prison. I know that this case and the case of Ronald Sanford have their differences, but I find the comparison interesting. David McGreevy is Caucasian. He was 22 when he murdered the three children who he was babysitting. He was intoxicated when he committed the murders, and he went on to mutilate the bodies. He did plead guilty to the murders, as Ronald Sanford did. So Ronald Sanford pleaded guilty to the murders of two elderly ladies, and he was only 13 years old when the murders were committed. He is African American. Both defendants were known to the police. Out of the two defendants, who would you have given a second chance to? Or maybe you don't feel that second chances are deserved, but when you've got someone who's 22 years old and you've got someone who's 13 years old, it makes for an interesting question, I think. The next issue to be discussed is the issue of racism. Statistics show that children of racial and ethnic minority backgrounds are hugely overrepresented at all stages of both the juvenile and general criminal justice systems. According to Amnesty International, the disproportion is worst for Black people, who make up only 15% of the population aged between 10 and 17, but they account for approximately 30% of the youth arrested, 40% of the youth held in custody in juvenile facilities, and 50% of all cases transferred by juvenile courts for trial in adult criminal courts. Sadly, but unsurprisingly, the estimated rate at which Black youth receive life without parole sentences is 10 times greater than the rate for white youth. Racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, including law enforcement, would account for this overrepresentation. Here are some other startling statistics uncovered by the Sentencing Project in 2012. Following a survey taken by people sentenced to life in prison as juveniles, it was found that 79% witnessed violence in their homes regularly. Fewer than half were attending school at the time they committed their offence. 47% were physically abused, like Ronald Sanford. And 77% of girls surveyed reported histories of sexual abuse. So at the start of the 1980s, the US went from rarely sentencing children to life without parole, but over that decade, the use of this punishment increased. Why? Was it as a response to the increase in crime rates? Well, no research has actually ever proven that the use of this extreme punishment deters juveniles from committing crimes. What it does show is that juveniles are unlikely to appreciate the reality and significance of what life without parole actually means. It suggested that the increase in the use of life without parole was largely political. An individual was more favourable politically if they took a strong stance against crime by implementing tougher laws and by increasing the length of prison sentences. Dr. William F. Schultz said the following, quote, "Untie the hands of state and federal judges and prosecutors. Give them options other than turning the courts into assembly lines that mass produce life without parole sentences for children, that ignore their enormous potential for change and rob them of all hopes for redemption." Did you know that in 11 out of the 17 years between 1985 and 2001, youth convicted of murder in the United States were more likely to enter prison with a life without parole sentence than adult murder offenders? So where are they now? Starting with Sean Lamont Rowe, Ronald Sanford's co-defendant, he served 2 years and 2 days of his almost 6 year sentence and was released on the 24th of March, 1991. On the 29th of October, 1999, Rowe was sentenced to 20 years for child molestation and 545 days for incest. He is currently incarcerated and is classed as a sexually violent predator. With regards to Ronald Sanford, at his guilty plea hearing, the trial court informed him that he was waiving his right to appeal his convictions, but not his right to post-conviction relief. The trial court failed to advise Sanford that he had a right to appeal his sentence. Between February 1991 and November 1995, Sanford filed 4 requests for trial court transcripts. All his requests were denied without explanation. He also filed 2 requests for transcripts with the juvenile court, which were also denied. Sanford didn't know what to do and so stopped filing motions. It was later explained to him that most courts would not give him a copy of his transcripts unless there was a petition for post-conviction relief pending. In July 2006, Sanford filed the petition and requested the transcripts. In September 2006, the trial court granted Sanford's motions for transcripts and scheduled a hearing. In January 2007, Sanford moved to reschedule the hearing because he hadn't received the transcripts. His motion was granted. The transcripts were not sent to Sanford, causing considerable delays. In May 2015, the trial court issued a written order with factual findings denying Sanford's petition for permission to file a belated appeal. Ronald Sanford is currently incarcerated at the Indiana State Prison, and as it currently stands, his earliest possible release date is the 17th of December 2070, as the judge ruled his sentences would be served consecutively. He has served his full sentence for the first murder, the sentence for which ended on the 3rd of February 2010. He is currently serving his sentence for the second murder, which ends on the 16th of December 2035. He then has to serve his sentence for the robbery charge until 2060, when he will then serve the final 10 years for the burglary charge. Many petitions have been created demanding that Sanford's case be looked into as a miscarriage of justice. Advocates for Ronald Sanford find it incomprehensible that the younger of the two boys would be solely responsible for wielding the knife that killed the two ladies, particularly as Sean Rowe was the one who walked away with the money. Rowe's evidence, which he gave in a rush to protect himself when he was arrested by the police, provided the majority of the evidence against Ronald Sanford. Sean Rowe walked away with a sentence just shy of 6 years and was released after serving just over 2 years, whereas Ronald Sanford will not be eligible for parole until he's almost 100 years old. Sanford's supporters believe that, in any event, he has repaid his debt to society. He's now 46 years old and has served 33 of those years in prison. Because of the age at which he was incarcerated, Sanford has never driven a car, owned a house, travelled abroad, or even been to prom. In an interview, Sanford was grateful to have found father figures in prison who guided and protected him. In an interview with Trevor McDonald, a very articulate Sanford explained that he had used his time in prison to expand his knowledge through reading. In his cell, there were books on eugenics and metaphysics, allowing him to mentally escape his cell for a short while. What do you think? Do you think an individual who murdered 2 pensioners deserves a second chance? Does your answer change when you take into account that he was just 13 years old, the younger of the two boys tied to the crime? And what about Ronald Sanford's background, a young black boy who grew up without a father figure and an alcoholic mother? How might his sentence have been different if he was Caucasian? Should Ronald Sanford get a second chance at life while he is still relatively young, like David McGreevy? tweet me with your thoughts at Student Verdict, because it genuinely interests me to see what people think. That concludes today's episode on the case of Ronald Lee Sanford. I'll put links to the petitions in the show notes that you can have a look at them and sign them if you'd like to. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you on the next one. Remember to keep living the dream.